is The Rundown from WUFT News, exploring our community from top to bottom. I'm Kristen Shearmont-Spina. Coming up on the show, a new investigation from Fresh Take Florida looks into the people who have won the Florida lottery over 100 times each. And later, a Gainesville nonprofit is encouraging teens to express themselves through music. But first, you may remember the Water First North Florida plan introduced earlier this year. It's a water reclamation project that would bring in treated wastewater from Jacksonville. Well, as WUFT's Ailey Shanes reports, one state senator earlier this week said the plan may be off the table, but that wasn't quite true.
Water First North Florida is spearheaded by the Suwannee and St. John's River Water Management Districts. Its goal is to recharge Florida's aquifer system and restore water flow. That's by pumping 40 million gallons of treated wastewater from Jacksonville into counties across North Florida. The hope is natural wetlands complete the filtration process and meet quality standards, but communities have raised concerns. In March, the North Central Florida Regional Planning Council voted to oppose the plan. The group represents 12 counties and small communities across the region, including Alachua, Bradford, and Dixie counties. Mary Alford is an Alachua County Commissioner and is on the Regional Planning Council.
I know that Jacksonville has a lot of industrial waste, right? We have problems already with PFAS, which are those forever chemicals in the water. We have problems with pharmaceuticals in the water. The treatment methods that I've heard discussed don't address those things.
And in Columbia County, community members have spoken out against the plan at commission meetings for months, with concern the wastewater may not be treated to its fullest extent. Marilee Gibson is a local activist from Fort White. She spoke after one of those meetings.
It's 14 counties wide, is the way that the diagram on the map shows. So every legislative person in those counties needs to be contacted. It's a big lift. But after seeing all of these people that come, I think they're ready for it.
Columbia County leaders ultimately voted to oppose Water First North Florida. Here's District 3 Commissioner Robbie Hollingsworth.
Current documentation shows limited benefit to our community while placing disproportionate risk on Columbia County. We cannot support a project that may compromise local resources without clear, direct value to our residents.
Well, now the plan has lost some financial backing. It's after State Senator Corey Simon wrote a letter that the Water First North Florida project is, quote, canceled in its current form. But the plan has not officially been canceled. The letter was just a recommendation and a request to go back to the drawing board. As the Florida House and Senate meet in Tallahassee to align their budgets, they've cut $20 million previously slated for the project. However, the plan costs over $1 billion. The Jacksonville Electric Authority has already committed $400 million for the plan, along with over $100 million from the St. John's River Water Management District. The Suwannee River Water Management District says it's aware of the letter, but it did not have additional comment. The Florida Springs Council and other water advocacy groups have expressed support for Simon's letter on social media. Ailey Shanes, WUFT News.
This is a developing story, and we'll provide updates as things change. If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shearmont-Spina. Florida has a lot of stories to tell. Do you know your community's history? It's time for a trivia question. Devil's Millhopper Geological State Park features a massive sinkhole. About how many steps lead to the bottom? Is it A, 54 steps, B, 132 steps, or C, 210 steps? Stay tuned to the end of the show for the answer. The odds of winning the lottery are low, like very low. But some players have won so big, so often, that their luck defies reason. That's according to a new investigation by Fresh Take Florida, a new service out of the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications. Reporters analyzed 1.5 million scratch-off claims between 2015 and 2025. They found about 70 players who had won more than 100 times during that time. And they found many of these players had unlikely connections to lottery retailers. Earlier this week, I spoke with one of the reporters on the project, Kyrie Lowry. I began by asking her how her team analyzed so much data.
We got this data from the Florida Lottery. They give us a big spreadsheet with kind of like winner name and information. Since, let's say, if you go play a scratch-off ticket and you win above $600, that then becomes public record and we're able to request that. So all of our data were of individuals winning $600 or more for one instance. And so we were able to get that data. And then from there, we start researching these individual names. For my story specifically, with people having connections to the stores that they're winning at, we used public record to look these people up and look at the actual owners of the stores where they're winning at. And what we found was a lot of these people had connections to the people we found that were owning the stores, whether that be like their sister or brother or aunt or uncle or things like that. And since we had already talked to statisticians and experts who said these hundreds of wins are very unlikely, that kind of also raised a red flag to us.
And what surprised you the most about your findings?
Florida's most prolific winner, who I talk about in my story, Akil P. Patel of Boca Raton, he's won over 300 times. And just putting that into perspective, one of the experts that we spoke to said that with the odds being what they are for each game that he won, that would be about as likely as him buying 1.8 million scratch-off tickets and then stacking those up, and that would go past reach the top of New York City's One World Trade Center, which is almost 2,000 feet up. It's 1,800 feet high. And you know, that's just very astounding to hear. I mean, I personally have played some scratch-off games here and there. I don't think I've won more than a few dollars, or one time I think I won like $50. And even that for me was like a wow, I can't believe this happened kind of thing. So to imagine someone winning so often, much less for this much money, it's just kind of extraordinary to think that that's happening. And that's not to say that these people aren't extremely rich or came into a lot of money, or like our story says, simply are just extremely lucky. But I think that these kind of comparisons that these statisticians gave us really helped put it into perspective. You hear, oh, someone won $1 million from a scratch-off ticket. Well, then you're thinking, okay, well, how often are they playing? How much money have they spent playing? And just for that to happen again and again, not saying that it's $1 million. It's just very crazy to hear, given that it's already very difficult odds on these tickets.
And so, having said that, what do you want your readers to take away from the story?
I think just having this awareness. We tried getting in touch with the Florida Lottery Department, the Palm Beach Post newspaper over in West Palm Beach. They were able to do a similar investigation about a decade ago, and the lottery had interviews with them. We requested an interview with the Florida Lottery for probably 2 months since this semester started, and just following up, and all we got was a written response. But I think it's really, really important for the people who are playing the lottery a lot. We also have a story in our project that Zoe Thomas did, which kind of explains where these lottery retailers are located. And a lot of the times they were located in low income and low education communities. And so what she found was that because of that, those are the people playing these scratch-off games. Those are the people who are spending their paycheck hoping to, you know, win it big. But the fact that this raises such red flags to watchdogs and statisticians, it should raise some red flags to them as well.
That was Fresh Take Florida reporter Kyrie Lowry speaking with me about a new investigation into the Florida Lottery. You can find the full project on our website, WUFT.org. If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shearmont-Spina. Coming up on the show, WUFT spoke with NPR's Weekend Edition host, Scott Simon, about his new book. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shearmont-Spina. Scott Simon is the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday on WUFT. In addition to his award-winning journalism, he's also an accomplished author. His 10th book was published earlier this month. It's called Ulysses S. Cat and Other Animals I Have Known. In it, Scott draws on something many of us can relate to, a lifetime of relationships with pets. WUFT's Morning Edition host Glenn Richards spoke with him about the book and his current brood.
You've got a French poodle who writes haiku?
Yes, Daisy. Daisy Richard Simone. She's a French poodle. She writes haiku. Well, what can I tell you? I tell the story in the book. I won't draw it out too much, but our daughters had been campaigning for a dog for some time after we lost our cat. We had a cat named Leona, who was a British cat, who had actually had escaped from a window in the British embassy, and we made a pact with the embassy official to keep her, but we had to raise her as a British cat. Leona. Life caught up with her. She was a wonderful childhood pet. Our daughters had been campaigning for a dog. And Caroline and I just weren't willing to make that commitment. And we went full presidential candidate press conference on our daughters. When they would say, "We want a dog," we'd go, "You know, we should have that conversation. I think that's a good conversation to have. Yes, let's have that conversation." Ultimately, my wife was walking along streets in Soho neighborhood in New York. There were two young women who turned out to be ballet dancers who were weeping because they couldn't have this puppy. It was a French poodle puppy because they traveled too much. My wife sent me a text message. I came down there. We got Daisy, named by her daughters. And yes, she writes haiku, which, you know, French poodles are very intelligent. And I tell Daisy, "You know, haiku is not a particularly sophisticated poetic system, all right, Daisy? It's not like epic poetry," but she's very happy with, yes, we have Daisy in our life.
So I see apparently you do have conversations with your animals the way we do. There's this kinship between humans and animals. You knew that going into the book. Is there anything that you discovered that you hadn't anticipated when you were writing this?
I think I hadn't quite anticipated, and it was a wonderful discovery, just how universal these relationships are, and for that matter, it's been going on for centuries. As some of your listeners might know, I covered the Siege of Sarajevo, and I did a lot of important, compelling human stories, but over the years, so many people have said to me, I remember the stories you did about pets in Sarajevo. And this is because our engineer then, Manoli Wetherell, and I had noticed what people were going through to keep their pets going during the Siege of Sarajevo, up to and including walking their dogs. And as I tell in the book, we came under sniper fire quite memorably. We're interviewing some people who were walking their dogs. And that began to add up in my mind as real humanitarian aid. Because I think people in this war-torn city had understood even more keenly than we do in the rest of the relatively peaceful world that animals take us out of ourselves. They remind us of something that can be in life. Their needs are simple. They react in the simplest, most direct way to register affection and to just want to be a part of our lives. They don't ask for much more than that. I mean, you know, food and shelter, but they just want to be with us. And that reminds us of the gift that we all have, that we can give to each other in this world.
That was journalist and author Scott Simon with WUFT's Glenn Richards. Their complete conversation is available on WUFT.org. Simon's new book, Ulysses S. Cat and Other Animals I Have Known, is available now with illustrations by renowned New Yorker cartoonist Liana Fink. If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shearmont-Spina. If you missed the first half of the show, no worries. You can always listen to previous episodes at our website, wuft.org/The Rundown. You can also find us wherever you get your podcasts. As a reminder, our trivia question this week was, Devil's Mill Hopper Geological State Park features a massive sinkhole. About how many steps lead to the bottom? Is it A, 54, B, 132, or C, 210? The answer's coming up at the end of the show. That's after a quick break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shearmont-Spina. Try to remember the first time you ever played an instrument. Maybe it was a simple melody you squeaked out on a recorder in elementary school. Well, for some teens in Gainesville, they've moved way beyond hot cross buns. WUFT's Carlos Corzo has this report from earlier this year on a nonprofit that encourages teenagers to express themselves through music.
We Rock Gainesville uses music to help teens and preteens establish themselves on sound stages around town. Founded in 2013 as a way to let girls enter the music scene, it's since expanded. Now, any children who aspire to become musicians are given an opportunity to showcase their talent in front of large crowds. The music played at its events typically fill the indie rock or pop genres. Co-director of We Rock Gainesville, Elizabeth Davis, spoke about the February 25th event at Heartwood Soundstage.
We had 10 different artists play. We had, I think it was 3 or 4 singer-songwriters, and then 6 bands. Everybody had parents and friends around. A lot of the kids wind up knowing each other, and so they support each other's sets, which is super cute.
Of the bands that played that night, there was one that was especially noticeable. The first ever jazz fusion band to perform with We Rock Gainesville, Mode 7. That's their music you're hearing right now. Its core members are 18-year-old trombonist Brian Curtis, 18-year-old pianist Zane Jelani Keel, 18-year-old drummer Nate Farrell, and 16-year-old electric bassist Liam Morrow. All band members are fond of and have played alternative music genres, but jazz is what's brought the four together. Curtis believes their backgrounds from alternative music only contributes to their playstyle and love of jazz.
Our drummer also had, he was in a separate band that he started in and then played with us. I've played in another band outside. Liam has played various different things either in school or we've all come from our own separate places. And so even though we've been playing for all of like 6 weeks, we've already been able to pull together, you know, probably over an hour's worth of music.
But why jazz? To Jelani Keel, jazz is the ultimate form of American music.
And I think that it represents the very definition of America, which is this melting pot. You have Western ideals of classical music combining with African rhythms. And I believe this jazz represents all of us, each American, each person.
Curtis loves the community that jazz forms, and doesn't understand how anyone could say they don't enjoy it.
In my opinion, jazz is one of the most welcomed way to get together. For two reasons. I mean, one, in the same idea, it pulls from a lot of influences. Jazz is a combination of many things, so there's bound to be some element of it that people enjoy. I also personally believe that jazz really challenges a musician. And I think because jazz asks the musician to express themselves so sincerely, it's felt so sincerely by the audience.
Elizabeth Davis says musicians like these are often neglected because some of them aren't adults. She's happy to give them the platform that many venues wouldn't.
Our entire music industry and music community here in Gainesville is geared towards bands that are over 18, over 21. So it's hard to get shows set up specifically for these young kids, but they have the same motivations and the same aspirations as any adult musician.
She plans to help throw another teen open mic on May 2nd at Bo Diddley Plaza. Applications will be open until May 3rd.
That was WUFT's Carlos Corzo reporting on a Gainesville nonprofit called We Rock that encourages teens to play music. Incidentally, that was a look back at this group's performance, which was recorded earlier this year. Now, according to Brian Curtis, their band, Mode 7, will perform tomorrow in Gainesville at Bo Diddley Plaza. That event starts at 7 p.m. Mode 7 is the last act and will close off the evening just before 9. The Rundown is a production of WUFT News out of the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications. The team that made the show possible this week includes Dave Bereswain, Dana Hill, Ailey Shanes, Glenn Richards, and Carlos Corzo. Special thanks to the Dean of the College, Hub Brown, and Newsroom Director, Ethan Majok. Do you have comments or questions about the show today or ideas for future shows? Email us at therundown@wuft.org. And if you want to go back and listen to this episode again or any of our previous episodes, you can find this show in podcast form on wuft.org/therundown or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find WUFT on social media. Our trivia question this week was, Devil's Millhopper Geological State Park features a massive sinkhole. About how many steps lead to the bottom? Is it A, 54 steps, B, 132 steps, or C, 210 steps? The answer is B, 132 steps. The sinkhole itself is 120 feet deep and 500 feet across. According to the Florida State Parks System, although sinkholes are common in Florida, Devil's Millhopper is unique because it's one of the few places in Florida where more than 100 feet of rock layers are exposed. The deepest exposed rock layer in the sinkhole is over 34 million years old. That's it for the Rundown. I'm Kristen Shearmont-Spina. See you next time.